The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
What is a cryptozoologist?
A cryptozoologist is someone who studies beasts that may or may not be real. They're also called cryptids. And so anybody who studies things like the Loch Ness Monster or Sasquatch, the Ponderay Paddler, someone who tries to locate those beasts that we always hear legends about, but we haven't proven their existence yet.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, and glad to have you with us for a conversation with Sharma Shields. We're talking about her novel, The Sasquatch Hunter's Almanac. In your novel, Eli Roebuck is the protagonist, and he's a man completely possessed by the desire to find a certain Mr. Krantz. And I'll give you the option. You can either explain that story or you can just read from the first chapter.
Well, I think I will read from the first chapter. This chapter is set in 1943 and is called The Handsome Guest. And this not only introduces us to our main character, Eli Roebuck, but also introduces this main character to the Sasquatch, who is also known as Mr. Krantz in the book. So this is The Handsome Guest. Eli Roebuck lived with his parents, Greg and Agnes, in a tiny cabin near State Line. Greg arranged a little rock border right where the line ran so that Eli could stand with 1 foot in Idaho and 1 foot in Washington and sense through the soles of his boots the difference between the two. Washington sap smelled sweeter. The soil was softer and less rocky. Idaho earth baked and hardened and stank like eggs. Or so Eli imagined. In reality, the environment was seamless. Dry white pine forest littered with decomposing needles and loose rock, and above, a hawk wheeling in the barrel blue sky. In the winter, snow fell and transformed the uneven terrain into a smooth white plain. Then it melted and the world returned to him as it had always been, faded brown and faded green, jagged and inviting. Other children hated living here. They wanted to be in Lilac City or Seattle or even Boise, where there were large toy stores and more cars than animals in the streets. Eli liked it here. He liked his house, he liked the forest, and he liked his parents. He was a happy kid. Eli's mother was not so happy. She was a slight young woman with a delicate brow and a low, serious voice. She rarely smiled. Eli had once heard his father say to her, "I don't know what makes you happy, Agnes. I wish I knew. I wish you'd tell me." Eli wished she'd tell him too, but she ignored most of what Eli's dad said. Like Eli, she was happiest when outdoors. She disappeared for long walks in the forest, following the fine-spun deer paths to areas where Eli was forbidden. If Eli ran after her and took up her hand, hoping to accompany her, she shook him gently away. She wanted to be alone, she said, to collect her thoughts. Eli pictured her kneeling on the forest floor, gathering her thoughts, glowing amber orbs, to her breast. Too in love with her to argue, he gave her anything she wanted, even her freedom. Sometimes she left Eli alone for hours, not coming home until just before dinner. Eli would pace the front yard, scared, near tears. He would watch the forest until she limped into view. She always returned, tired but radiant, apologetic and affectionate. She would take up Eli's hand and hurry inside to make supper. They would work side by side, Eli giddy with relief, singing songs and chatting amiably, until Eli's dad called to them from the foyer. Then her mood would darken, a shift as unsurprising as the sunset. Eli wondered, what did she do in the forest? What was it there that made her so happy? He awoke one morning and his mother washed his face and ears and combed his hair and put him in his Sunday best. She forbade him to go outside because, she explained, she wanted him to meet someone very dear to her. Eli's father had left for work hours ago when it was still cool and dark. Already the day's heat was pushing into the house. "Who is it?" Eli said. "Is it a friend of Dad's?" Agnes leaned over her hand mirror, pinching her cheekbones. It's a stranger, darling. You'll see. He's very interesting. The most interesting man I've ever met. You'll like him. Eli helped Agnes with the broom and the dustpan, careful not to dirty his clothes. Something savory baked in the oven. The house grew hotter yet and groaned. Finally, the visitor arrived. Hearing the knock, Agnes raced to the door and swept it open. There stood her guest, the most interesting man. Eli tried not to stare. He did not see a man at all. What he saw was an enormous ape crushed into a filthy pinstriped suit. He remembered a book from school about exotic beasts, the giant apes who lived in the savage countries of the world. And the guest resembled those creatures, deep hooded brow, small blank eyes, thin-lipped mouth like a long pink gash. And the hair. The guest was so hairy that Eli was unsure of the color of his skin. Beneath the thick brown fur, his flesh, tough and charred like strips of dried deer meat, appeared red in some places, purple in others. The guest even smelled of hair, badly, like a musty bearskin rug singed with a lit match. Eli was horrified and delighted. Remembering his manners, he stepped to the side and said politely, "Please, sir, come in." The guest's small, round eyes raked over Eli. He cleared his throat and lumbered into the room, swinging his powerful arms. Well, Eli thought, he walks like a man, even if he doesn't exactly look like one. But then Eli noticed the guest's wide, shoeless feet, two hairy sleds that moved noiselessly over the wooden floorboards as though through a soft snow. "Do you want some tea?" his mother asked. "It's scalding hot, just the way you like it." The guest spoke. The noise startled Eli, a short sentence of senseless bleats and hoots. Agnes responded as if she understood. She handed over the teacup, and the guest handled it clumsily before dropping it, with a roar of annoyance, onto the floor. Eli hurried to clean up the mess himself. He didn't even wince when a piece of china stuck him in the index finger. His mom offered her guest the teapot instead, and he drank greedily from its spout. Eli watched in sick fascination. "What's your name?" Eli asked, gazing up at the hairy beast as he gulped and slobbered. "Eli," his mother said, "it's rude to stare. This is Mr. Krantz. He's a dear friend. What do you think of the house, Mr. Krantz?" Mr. Krantz was about to toss the empty teapot on the floor, but Eli, always a quick boy, reached up on tiptoe to take it from him. "Here, Mr. Krantz," he said kindly, "let me help you." Mr. Krantz released the pot. He briefly patted Eli's head, and the impact made Eli's teeth clatter. "I'm happy you've met my son," Eli's mom said to Mr. Krantz. "I can tell Eli likes you. He admires strong men." Eli had never stated this aloud, but he supposed his mother was right. There was much to admire about Mr. Krantz. For one, his immensity. He was easily the largest person Eli had ever seen, over 7 feet tall, and 3 or 4 times heavier than Eli's own dad. Second, his hairiness. He was as furry and sleek as a grizzly bear. Last, his unpredictability. Eli found unpredictability the most alluring trait of all. Now, for instance, Mr. Krantz was fondling a houseplant. If Eli so much as sneezed in a houseplant's direction, his mother scowled, but she watched Mr. Krantz patiently as he broke a leaf and then held it up to his nose, sniffing it. Mr. Krantz held the ruined leaf out toward Eli like it was a gift. "Hydrangea," Eli said, touching its edge. Mr. Krantz put the leaf in his mouth. "Poor thing," Eli's mom said. "You're famished. I made biscuits, the ones I brought you before, Mr. Krantz, drenched in butter." She hurried to the kitchen, humming. Eli smiled. Here was another reason to like Mr. Krantz. He clearly made his mother very happy. Then I will skip down a little bit, a couple pages forward here, and we will continue on with the strange relationship that's happening between Mr. Krantz and Eli. Mr. Krantz ruffled Eli's hair and then lifted his gaze to the face of the woman watching him. Eli's mom had grown very still, standing before Mr. Krantz like a blossomed flower, her face open and shining. Seeing her, Mr. Krantz's eyes gleamed with a new hunger. Crazily so. Eli, uncomfortable, reached for his mother's skirt and tugged. She dropped to his side. She wrapped her arms around him and kissed his face. "Oh, my baby," she said to him, "how I'll miss you." "Miss me? My piano lesson is only an hour. I'll be home for stew." His mother blinked at him heavily, as if she were fighting sleep, and then she drew him fast to her breast. She smelled of Palmolive and cake batter. Eli would never forget the warmth of her smell. "I do love you," she said. "Never doubt it, sweetheart." Eli wavered, confused. She went to the closet and retrieved a packed suitcase. She groaned lifting it, and Mr. Krantz came forward to take it from her. "Mr. Krantz," she said bravely, straightening and extending her hand, "I'm ready." Mr. Krantz swallowed up her hand with his free one. They went out the door together, the woman lean and pale and barely breathing, the other hairy and dark and panting like a dog in heat. Like Mr. Krantz, Agnes was barefoot. Their feet pressed into the mud of the yard, winding toward the forest. Large prints, small prints, monstrous feet, dainty feet, heaviness, freedom. His mother did not turn toward him again, but Mr. Krantz turned as he reached the small line of stones parting Washington State from Idaho. The guest sorrowed for him, Eli could see. It was Mr. Krantz's attempt at an apology. Eli panicked. "Come back," Eli called after them. "You can't leave." Mr. Krantz put an enormous hand on the small of Agnes's back. She lowered her head. They hastened into the woods together, extinguished by the trees. Eli hated Mr. Krantz then. He was not a man at all, but an animal. Like an animal, he took what he wanted, regardless of who suffered for it. He was just the same as a bear or a cougar or any other woodland predator. But then what did that make Eli's mother? Who was she? Woman, mom, animal, wife? Maybe just nothing, Eli thought. Maybe she wants to be nothing. And he wished he could make her nothing, too. He considered following them. The sun slanted down and baked the footprints into place. He thought of his dad. He returned to the house, the door smacking shut behind him. The room smelled of biscuits, of simmering stew. Eli sat on the sofa and folded his hands in his lap. He furrowed his tiny brow. He would wait for his dad. He would go to his piano lesson. Most important, he would think up a better story than the one he had just witnessed. His dad was a practical man. He would not believe a word of it.
So from that moment, Eli is pretty much frozen in time. His heart is broken. He's been abandoned by his mother. And he's fixated on those footprints. So he becomes a podiatrist.
Yes, he does. He becomes a podiatrist first before he becomes a cryptozoologist.
What makes him give that up and just go whole hog into this search for Mr. Krantz?
He sees the Gimlin-Patterson video replayed on a talk show, or he hears about it on a talk show that I was picturing as similar to Johnny Carson, a late-night talk show that would have been around at the time when Eli was an adult. And he sees that and starts realizing that other people are pursuing this creature and that maybe that's kind of what he should be doing too. And I think that's really when he starts to shift toward seeking out the creature as his full-time work rather than working as a podiatrist.
He starts a nonprofit called SNARL.
Yes. That's the Sasquatch National Research Lab. Yes, I was very proud of that acronym.
It's great. Listening to The Right Question, I'm Cherie Newman talking with Spokane, Washington author Sharma Shields. If you'd like to listen to this program online, the audio is posted at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link on our Facebook page. We'll be right back to talk about how Sherman Alexie influenced Sharma's writing at a critical moment and find out where her sense of humor came from. Don't go away. wrote in the acknowledgments section of the book that Sherman Alexie influenced this book somehow.
Yes. After I finished writing the first draft of the book, I was just starting to edit a second draft, and it was going to be a monstrous edit. I knew that I would need to delete several dozen pages, which I did. I think I deleted between 70 and 80 pages in that first draft. And I rewrote a ton as well. But right before I got started with that, I was researching Sasquatch online, and I happened upon the Sasquatch poems, which Sherman Alexie wrote and published in Zizava. And the thing that really struck me about those poems was sort of the way that Sherman, even though he calls himself a skeptic, the way that there was this tone that partially believed in Sasquatch, and there wasn't the doubt there about its existence. That wasn't really the purpose in his poems, to doubt it. It was to allow it to exist in the world. So when I read the Sasquatch poems, they really gave me this idea to commit fully to Mr. Krantz as a Sasquatch. So I went back in and wrote chapters that were, in fact, concentrating on his perspective of the world. And I don't think I would have been able to do that without coming across those poems. It was a really aha moment for me in the revisualization of the book. And I'm really glad. I think the first draft I was like, he could be a Sasquatch. He also might not be. And I just wasn't committing and allowing him to be a Sasquatch. And I'm really glad I ended up doing that.
Well, there are several darkly funny scenes in this novel, and I tried to choose a favorite, but the piano recital and the parade float ended up being tied for first because they are both hilarious, and they both show Eli's obsession. And I remember that that dark sense of humor also ran through your story collection, Favorite
Yes.
Monster. Do you know the source of that humor?
Boy, I don't know. I think it probably started up long ago, maybe trying to impress my older brother and be trying to be funny and make him laugh, I think, was always something I kind of cherished growing up. And I just always kind of have had that darker sensibility, too.
I made a note of this simile because when I read this sentence, I just howled with laughter. His wife stood squat and white beside him like a freshly painted lighthouse, grinning broadly.
That's so funny. I don't even remember writing that sentence. That's really funny. Yeah.
So great. Things like that just appear in your head and you put them in the book?
Or? Yeah. Yeah, definitely. You know, as a writer, you frequently meet people that kind of don't quite get why you're a writer, and they might say some comments that are maybe they even mean as sort of a compliment, like, wow, that's certainly brave of you, you know, to be a, to be a writer. Not a lot of money in that, you know, those sorts of comments. And but that are also these kind of a little bit patronizing comments. So I think that couple was sort of a manifestation of that a little bit. The guy who is sort of pedantic in the way he talks to people, and then his wife, who tries to make up for it by being overly exuberant. So that was a fun little chapter to write. I mean, I think especially when you're a parent and you go to these events for your children and there are other parents there with children the same age, you're bound to meet people that are very different from you. And so I think there's always a lot of humor that can come from that intermingling where people are sort of outside of their comfort zone, which Eli very much is in the piano recital scene. End in the scene with the parade. I mean, this is a guy who has never volunteered to help out with his daughter's school ever. And he does it for the sole purpose of making this lifelike Sasquatch model.
Because the school has changed their mascot to the Sasquatch.
Yes. So he's not really there for the right reasons. He's not there for bonding time with his daughter. He's there to prove himself as a scientist to the entire town of Lilac City. And so that really sets up this kind of humorous fall when everything literally goes up in flames in that chapter.
A couple of times during the story, you drew a parallel between Eli's hunt for the Sasquatch and poetry.
Yes.
Describe definitely. What's going on in your mind when you make that comparison.
Well, I was just at a reading a couple of nights ago, and someone asked me about where Eli came from. And I was telling them about how I read an article when I was researching Sasquatch through the ProQuest database. I came across all of these articles on Grover Krantz, who was a famous cryptozoologist at Washington State University. And he was also an anthropologist and was a very revered professor and scientist in his own right, but he very much believed in Sasquatch. And at the end of his career, he was really so dedicated to the idea of Sasquatch and so desperate to find this animal in the woods that he would drive around in an ATV wielding a rifle with a headlamp on, and he would be screaming at the top of his lungs for Sasquatch to come out so he could shoot him dead and provide the body to finally have proof. And there was something so vulnerable and desperate in taking those measures that really resonated with me. And I really saw myself in Grover Krantz at that moment, because that's kind of how I feel about writing, that I'm sort of the crazy nut out there wearing the headlamp and, you know, wielding the weapon and driving around in the woods screaming for my writing career to happen or something, you know. So I saw this sort of comic parallel between myself and Grover Krantz. And of course, Eli Roebuck he's definitely fashioned after Grover Krantz a little bit. And I ended up naming the Sasquatch after Krantz as kind of a homage to him, I suppose. I think there are those references to poetry, and it comes from Eli's second wife, who is a poet, and she isn't a very dedicated poet. She does it kind of here and there and not exactly committed to it, but has this love of it. So she sometimes parallels her desire to write poetry to his desire to find the Sasquatch. And it's also meant as, a little bit of comedy. It really frustrates Eli that she would insult him in that way, because he feels that his quest is he's much more dedicated and it's much more noble. So.
She can see the elusiveness in the search for the Sasquatch and in the search for the right word when you're making a poem, but he can't see it in reverse.
Exactly, right. I mean, she's very understanding and very patient with him and accepting of kind of the metaphor that his search for the Sasquatch represents. But he doesn't extend her the same courtesy.
The Sasquatch Hunter's Almanac has just barely arrived in bookstores, but it's been endorsed by Oprah Magazine. Richard Russo compared it to Kafka's story, The Metamorphosis, and it's been optioned for television. This is really big stuff. How are you dealing with it?
I've been really thrilled and excited. I did get very nauseous and nervous one week in Spokane right before a big article was published there in just our local weekly magazine. And that was the most terrified I've been, because it really talked a lot about sort of personal things that had happened to me in high school. It talked a lot about my problems with alcoholism and talked about, my MS diagnosis, a lot of really personal things. And I think it's kind of funny that the most nervous I've been about all of the media occurring nationally has been just within my own hometown. That was kind of the scariest article coming out to me. But ever since it came out, I've been feeling better and better and just more relieved that my story's out there and I was able to kind of come clean with Spokane, and in that way it was very cool. So right now I feel pretty good with everything. Really thrilled. It's amazing. I'm really grateful for all the attention the book has received, and I know that these things can kind of go up and down, so I'm going to enjoy the upswing while I have it and prepare to hunker down and start writing the next project and prepare for the low swing, which I'm sure is on its way too.
Well, I don't know with this book, unless they do something terrible with it on the TV option, something you really, really hate.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it's probably true, and I shouldn't speak for all writers, but it's probably true that to some extent we don't mind the lack of attention when it happens, because I think, at least for me, when I'm happiest is when I'm really writing and working on a project and feeling really married to that project. And I really got to enjoy that for a couple of years with the Sasquatch Hunter's Almanac, and I'm kind of chomping at the bit to feel that way again about the new project I've been tinkering with. But it's hard to get into it in the middle of a lot of publicity and touring, so I'm hoping in the next couple weeks I can really start getting back to that more private place with it all.
Yeah. I know I've talked to some authors who are in the middle of their second book or whatever book, and they're out touring for their first one, and they have such a hard time shifting their mind back to the previous book while they're in the middle of the
second. Definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's one of my worries that I've taken such a long break from it. I may have interrupted the rhythm of it entirely, and maybe I'll have to start over new again. But that's okay, because I have no problem with deleting or abandoning work. I'm really good at just deciding it's not working and forgetting that it ever existed.
Yeah, for some reason, I just don't think you're going to have a problem. I remember from our conversation a couple of years ago that you started making books, actually making physical books, when you were a tiny child. So I think
it's
you're
true.
Doing what you're supposed to be doing.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I am. I mean, it makes me so happy, and it makes me so happy that it's being so well received. I really do just feel a lot of gratitude for that. I feel like I get to experience this rare joy of doing what I love for, I don't know if you can call it a living so much yet, but it's kind of a living, and I'm getting to do it, and it's a dream come true for me, big time.
Thank you for a fresh and delightful novel.
Oh, thank you so
Something
much.
Really yeah. different.
It is. It's weird, and I'm proud of its weirdness for sure.
Sharma Shields lives in Spokane, Washington. Look for more information about her and the Sasquatch Hunter's Almanac at our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. Or you can also find the link on our Facebook page. Hey, thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.